Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact.
Knowing what I know about a footwear production, there's absolutely no way you can profitably make and sell a shoe for $45 that applies the same rigorous sensitivities on the environment and animal welfare and frankly, just quality craftsmanship that we use in our production to do so at that price.
My guest today is Joey Zwillinger, co-founder and co-CEO of Allbirds, the fastest growing shoe company in the world. Joey has long been passionate about making things from renewable resources, which led him to start Allbirds and begin tackling sustainability issues in the footwear industry. Prior to co-founding Allbirds, he spent 6 years at biotech firm Solazyme, leading its renewable chemical business, developing and selling high-performance algae-based chemicals into various industries. Previously, Joey worked in advisory investment roles at Industry Ventures, Deloitte Consulting, and Goldman Sachs. He sits on the board of education profit Stiles Hall, as well as the advisory board of Wharton's Baker Retail Center. Joey, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul. Pleasure to be here.
It's so great to be speaking to somebody who is a pioneer in the world of sustainable fashion. And so I'm going to approach today's conversation as a mini MBA in how to create a sustainable brand.
That sounds high pressure.
No pressure at all. You have succeeded beyond anybody's wildest dreams. So let's start just in a dispassionate way, analyzing why Allbirds has been such a remarkable success. Mm. And I think if you're trying to build a sustainable brand, you've got to start with the fundamentals of why consumers have fallen in love with the product. So tell us why you think Allbirds has been a success.
Well, I think the way you even frame that question is a large part of the answer. You know, the fact that we have decided very early on to start a sustainable brand didn't mean that we were making sustainable products. It meant we were making great products. And we really needed to have our customers absolutely fall head over heels in love with what the product did for them on a day-to-day basis. When they slipped into the shoe, it had to feel incredible. When 6 months later, they were walking around in a pair of Allbirds, they needed to feel that same love for the product. And so we designed everything with that in mind. And that said, at the same time, our North Star, we call it making better things in a better way, is around making great products, but doing it incredibly sustainably. So we had a set of values and principles that we started the business with, which we've really never veered from. And I think staying methodical and true to those values, and those are around sustainability. It's around the fact that climate change is the problem of our generation. And if there's anything we can do to help mitigate the impact that humans are having on climate change and global warming, that's something worth doing.
So we're going to dig in a lot to the kind of sustainability and all the pioneering work you've done on that. But I want to stay just on the bare bones commercial dimensions of Allbirds for a moment, because you won't be able to achieve any of the kind of planetary benefits that you're hoping to achieve unless you're the commercial success that you obviously are. So the fashion industry, the apparel and footwear industry have all been through this tremendous revolution in the last 10 years. All the kind of conventional economics have been rewritten. Wholesale's under duress. Retail is being reinvented. So tell us just at a kind of business level, what you went about doing that made you a commercial success from the actual business plan point of view.
Yeah, and again, I think your question's spot on. So when we started the business, we saw that the entire global footwear industry, which is about a $375 billion industry at retail, there's 20 billion pairs of shoes sold every year. And everyone was based on the U.S. wholesale market. So every global footwear company made a product, and the way that they built their cost structure was that they expected to have a markup at retail about 53%. And so the cost that these companies were able to afford to make in their product was very low. and price sensitivity is increasing. And because of e-commerce and how that's changed the landscape, information is very efficient. You can go and find a pair of your favorite brand in a store, and then you can click online and find the best price you possibly can. And why would you get suckered or duped into buying it at that store? So it's putting a huge amount of pressure on retailers that have other people's brands. So we saw what was happening there, and then we saw the knock-on effect of that, which is that two things happen. One is that the brands focus on trying to get consumers' attention when they're looking at the shelf, and there's a shoe wall of 200 styles of shoes. What do you do in order to attract a consumer's attention? You put a flashy logo on it and bright colors. That's not necessarily what the consumer wants, but it sure does pop off the shelf. And if it pops off the shelf, you'll try it on, and that might make you buy the shoe. The second thing is, in order to make that work, get when people try on the shoe and make it profitable, you use the fastest, quickest, and the cheapest materials you possibly can find. And that is not, you don't hear in what I said something about the environment. And so what we've been able to do is circumvent the wholesale model. And by going direct to consumer, what we have been able to do is exchange all of that rent or the value in the value chain, the profit that's typically reserved for retailers, and we put that into high value materials. So the first product that we launched was made out of super fine merino wool, which is a fiber that is harvested off, humanely harvested off of the backs of merino sheep in New Zealand. It's the finest wool in the world, and it's usually reserved for $5,000 suits and Brioni and Tom Ford and things like that. We developed the fabric in Italy, and we're able to put that into a $95 shoe, which is in the US how much we sold that original product for. And we offered something of incredible value to consumers with delightful comfort that came from that material. And these wholesale brands would never have been able to afford to do that. If they did, they would have done it at, 2x the price of what we were able to offer it at. So that trade-off, that fundamental trade-off, the business basics of we're giving you way more value as a consumer for the money that you pay than you could get from the traditional value chain of the brands out there.
So I understand the wholesale model is under siege. Wholesalers take a very significant amount of your margin, and they cause you to market and indeed design and then cost your products in a way that is not necessarily in the best interest of the consumer. And that means that you've built a model that is direct to consumer, and that direct to consumer model has all the benefits that you've just described, but it has one great challenge, and that is it's a wildly crowded market in and of itself. You've got to burst through the endless universe of the internet, and you have to grab people's eyeballs in ways that are, it's not a done deal that you can do that. So how did you succeed when you picked a channel, which I fully understand the economics of and the rationale for, how did you succeed in the challenges that that channel then presents?
Yeah, so reflecting on how crowded that marketplace is, when we started, we said, let's not do a fashion approach to this, where you'd come out with a spring line of products, and we launched in March of 2016, and come out with a spring line, and you have five styles, maybe you have a full outfit that goes along with it. We came out with one product, and that singularity of voice allowed us to break through, because what consumers understood and what we were trying to convey with that product offering was that we studied the sneaker market. We did a lot of research and development on a very unique material that created a unique experience and comfortable experience for customers. And we did our damnedest to make the best sneaker we possibly could. And instead of the paradox of choice, when you go back to that 200 style shoe wall, we gave you one. And we said, look, we've done our best effort at inventing a product that we think is going to delight you, and you're going to be able to use it through a whole host of different activities as you're bouncing from a light workout to work to brunch with your friends to whatever. And that's the way consumers had changed their behavior. And these wardrobes and apparel to a certain degree, but shoes certainly hadn't kept up. And so we offered that singular solution to a need that consumers clearly had, and the value chain of this wholesale model had prevented brands from seeing that opportunity. And so I think that clarity of voice is really what allowed us to stand out. Needless to say, when Time Magazine said it was the most comfortable shoe in the world on the day we launched, that was also helpful.
How did you get to Time Magazine, because, you know, there's an infinite number of people who are trying to get that kind of coverage. So again, you pick one product, you don't do a multiple SKU count, that makes your inventory more efficient. And that makes a ton of sense and is a very smart thing to do. But people still have to find out about you.
There's no magic. Yeah. There's no magic in this. It's not like we had a secret marketing trick that worked. The reality is my co-founder, Tim Brown, had been working on this for years before. I had a number of kind of small trials and iterations and different fabrics that he'd been playing with around wool. And when we had our final version of it that we sent to some editors at Time, they tried it on. We had a conversation with them. And the promise that we made to them was that it was going to be great. It was going to be different. You're going to love it. Turned out to be true. And so it's like business basics. It's not about just having a new model that tricks the rest of the brands because we go direct to consumer. That happens to be our sales strategy, and that helps us give a lot more value to consumers, but that doesn't give us an excuse to not make an amazing product. And if we don't keep innovating on new materials and amazing products like that, we'll fail. And so that's been our mantra since that day of first launching, is continue to innovate, go as slow as we have to go in order to make great products, and never make a product unless we think it's fantastic.
So you started online and with clicks, and then you've now done what is a well-worn transition from clicks to bricks, and you are now retailing yourselves, including here in London. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How has that expansion, you know, with all the associated risks and rents and overheads and costs associated with it, but also that sense of being able to engage with consumers face-to-face in a more tactile way, how is that transition going?
It's going really well. And one of the things I mentioned earlier around physical retail having issues with when you have those 200 styles, you got to remember that those are retailers selling other brands' goods. When we are selling our own products, we have a space that is curated to give you the exact education and experience around the materials that we're making and the feel that you that our product elicits. And that's around this tactile idea of material innovation, these wonderful different products that we've made. And it is, we've always believed that that physical experience is going to outshine a website every single day. And so if you're like, you know, the 80 some percent of people who only buy shoes offline in physical, brick and mortar stores, this is going to be a great solution for you. And I think it's also a great place to capture your attention. And when you're walking by our store, it's a beautiful showcase for us. You come in and try on the shoe. And if you happen to want to buy further styles from us later, you already know your size. It's going to fit you great. And you can ship it from e-com. And so that's been our approach. And we're having a great deal of success with it. We have 15 stores by the end of this year, and we're going to continue to build brick and mortar globally. That's 7 in the U.S. and 8 outside the U.S. so far. And we've decided to take that global approach because we think this is a global industry with a big global problem we're trying to help solve and do our little part in. And we are also seeing success globally. So the same product market issues are the same ones we address in the U.S. and same ones here in London. And we expect the same in Asia as well.
Do you find that because people are not really used to buying shoes online, that the first couple times they do it, you get returns because of fit issue, and then once they lock into a size, then you sort of have them for life, as it were?
Our return rate is low, so we've been pleasantly surprised. I think when we started the business, we looked at, you know, the famous stories of companies like Zappos with, you know, 30-40% returns and whatever the rumors are out there for how many times people basically use their house as a retail store and just wardrobe, as they call it in the industry, and send 5 pairs there and send 4 back, or sometimes all 5. That hasn't happened to us. Unfortunately, you know, one of the things we did early was just realize that if we left all the seams off of the design, we had a supple fabric that was able to kind of accommodate a lot of different foot sizes and shapes. Well, we'd have an opportunity to reduce the returns. We didn't offer half sizes when we started the company. Now we've introduced a couple styles that necessitate that, just given that there's a tighter fit. But we avoided half size. And I think those two aspects of our material design and then that business strategy of not having half sizes actually was pretty helpful. And we couldn't sell to a subset of the population that absolutely needed a half size, but that was a trade-off that we thought was worthwhile, and so far so good.
So it seems as though in some ways you've unpicked the traditional fashion model. Seasons, multiple styles, runway shows, inefficient marketing, being manacled to wholesalers, designing things with a glossy perspective that are trying to satisfy editorial rather than what customers want, and have gone back to basics. And in those basics is really smart economics. You could have just left it at that and gone, well, I've just created a great model. But you've also layered on top of that a deep and profound and genuine commitment to sustainability. So let's dig into that for a moment. Let's start with the wool. It's obviously just flat out a superior product and an innovative and interesting and novel one. But tell us a little bit more about wool from a sustainability perspective.
Sure. So we have, there's a lot of different wool out there. There's two types of sheep that produce wool. They call them crossbreeds is one, which is typically where meat comes from. And then merino, which is used primarily for the wool. And so merino has these particular and their inherent properties where it manages moisture really well. It mitigates odor, and so it locks in any odor causing bacteria in the structure of the fibers. It temperature regulates because it creates little micro air pockets between your skin and the fibers, given the shape of those fibers. And it's really beautiful, soft, and cozy. It feels like a cashmere sweater when you use the right quality of it, which we've chosen. So we knew that there were some physical properties that were incredible and inherent. And if you look back in the 40s and 50s, that was what everyone was wearing. All the soldiers were wearing beautiful wool fabrics in their coats in the Russian winters and whatnot in World War II. And then all of a sudden, the synthetic industry gave a different opportunity. It was faster, it was cheaper, it was using petroleum, which I think is generally a stupid premise, and I wish we'd gone back in time and changed that, but that's what happened. And as a result, the population of sheep in a place like New Zealand went from 100 million to about 28 million today. And that is, you can trace that exactly back to the rise of the synthetic industry. And what people traded with that was they traded all those beautiful qualities, but they got a much cheaper product. And so we decided to go back to basics, as you said, and do this fundamental fiber that's just inherent to nature. These merino sheep, the ones that we've selected, we focused on a particular type of merino sheep. It's raised predominantly in New Zealand, but also in South Africa and to a lesser degree in Australia, with the best approach to animal welfare. The animals are treated great, environmental management. These sheep each have about 2 acres of land for each sheep. And it's topographically one of the most beautiful places in the world, looking over the lakes of Queenstown, New Zealand. So they have a great view as well. I'm not sure they appreciate it as much as we do. But so we've gone and we've selected these, and we've made sure that we audit every one of the 96 farms that we source wool from through a group called New Zealand Merino, which certifies every one of the farms with the ZQ certification. And that allows us to feel comfortable that the promise that we're making to our customer, that the animals are treated great, the land is treated great, and the environmental impact that we're making is what we say it is. And so that said, in raising animals, there's still a substantial amount of carbon impact because of the methane production from basically sheep burping. Methane is one of the largest greenhouse warming potential gases that exists. It's much, much higher than just carbon dioxide. And so what we're working on, and this is why we say better things in a better way. You can never really get the best in that statement. And we always believe that there's imperfections in our process and we need to do a lot better. So one of the things we're investing in now is regenerative farming, where we're looking at opportunities to sequester carbon inside the soil. And that's just a different technique that you use in farming. It's a little harder, it's a little more expensive, but it's an area where we think we can then change the paradigm so that we have the lowest carbon footprint material as well as the most natural and the best properties. So in the meantime, what we've decided to do is take any of the carbon emission impact that our wool harvesting makes, along with everything else in our supply chain, from manufacturing to shipping, and even when people take a car into work at our headquarters, and we take the carbon impact of all of that activity from our company, and we offset that, and we fund projects that capture carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to pay for the pollution that we're creating. And our principle there is that if every company did that practice and was able to try to treat their carbon impact just like another cost line on their profit and loss statement, that climate change would not be a problem. And so I think we are imposing a carbon tax on ourselves in a way. And in doing so, we hope that we're showing the way for a lot of other companies to start acting like every company should act, pay for the pollution that they're creating, and in so doing, pave a way for what we optimistically think could be a very large part of the solution to climate change.
When you carbon offset, do you do a calculation, calculate your top line revenue, and then take a percentage of that and allocate it or to a third party who then carbon offsets in their own way, presumably in a way that you're satisfied? Or do you actually proactively decide what sustainable businesses or carbon offsetting businesses you want to invest in yourselves?
So what we do is we go very bottoms up. We look at every single product and we count down to the machine that we use in the fabrication, down to the farming practice and everything. We count exactly how many grams of carbon are emitted in our process. We multiply that by the number of shoes we produce or the other products that we produce. We add on top the small portion that we emit via our workforce and our headquarters and whatnot. And that gives us a sum total of how much emissions that we've created as a company. We count that, and then we look for different projects to finance that wouldn't exist unless we finance them. So that incremental addition to the world is very important in making sure it's a true offset. And we look at things like forestry projects. We look at methane capture from animal production or landfills at times. And we do energy projects like solar and wind. And so we like to position and choose those projects. And given that we have the discretion and that not that many people are financing these, there's quite a bit of projects out there. And we can focus on choosing ones that impact our local communities where we actually sell, which is a nice added benefit, albeit not necessary for this process and the principles that I was outlining. So that's the process we use.
What are the projects that you've helped finance that you love most? A reforestation or wind and solar farms or, you know?
I'll tell you, it's funny. I like the least sexy ones because I think it's the most effective. When we take methane out of the atmosphere and we do it through some of these projects in animal production and like, you know, dairy or meat farming in the U.S., this is one of the areas where a very substantive amount of the carbon emissions are happening in agriculture. And so I think while very unsexy, it'd be nice for me to sit here and say that beautiful forest that you just walked through is something we planted all the trees and whatnot. I think that the brass tacks of getting rid of this problem is where what excites me. And so I love those unsexy ones where we're just taking methane right out of the atmosphere, capturing it out of landfills and making sure that the whole cycle works for the planet.
Amazing. You source eucalyptus and sugarcane from South Africa and Brazil, respectively. And you have this really interesting proprietary technology that you've then counterintuitively open sourced in the way that you produced your soles of your shoes. Mm. So tell us about what's good about those soles and then tell us why you've done the seemingly non-competitive thing of making it available to others.
Yeah. So this Brazilian process is something I'd interacted with in my previous part of my career. And so I had a pretty good vantage point on the benefits of using sugarcane, which is one of the most efficient places in the world where you capture carbon out of the atmosphere and turn it into something that people use. So a very quick renewable cycle. If I could just explain that for a minute. If you think about a car going down the street in Brazil, blowing CO2 out of its tailpipe, that CO2 is emitted into the atmosphere. Sugarcane then captures that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and with just a few photons from the sun and a little rainfall, it translates that CO2 into carbon that is fixed in the form of sugar inside of the stalks of the sugarcane. When that sugarcane is then processed, the sugar is made and refined into sugar to put on your table and drink with your tea, and then the waste product of that is taken and used for different industrial processes. We knew that we could take that waste stream and create a version of it that is a highly renewable version of the most commonly used and largest volume input into the sneaker industry, which is this foam midsole that gives you the soft cushion under your feet. And so we developed this with a partner down in Brazil called Braskem. It's the largest green chemical company in South America and one of the largest in the world. And we co-developed this thing we now call sweet foam, but the base is something called EVA. It's ethylene vinyl acetate for those chemists on the line. And we've done that in a way that actually sequesters more carbon than it takes to produce that material. So what that means is every time somebody makes a shoe out of this sweet foam material, it's better for the planet than if that shoe hadn't been made. And that is that, like, our mantra as a company is, if we can be as good as a tree, if our company can be as good as a tree where we suck CO2 and we produce something valuable to the world in oxygen, that's our goal. That's a very lofty goal. It's not something we're achieving today. But this is a great example of a process that does achieve that. And so we thought, what better way to actually spread the impact of our work than to open source it and allow lots of other companies to use it? And so that's exactly what we did. And that sounds extremely altruistic. There's also a pragmatic business reason. So the more people who use it, more companies who use this material, the lower the cost is going to be for everyone. And this is where, and we do special stuff with this material after we get this base material. So it's not like that's the only IP that we have. We've done a lot of really interesting chemistry around this to make it extraordinarily comfortable when you put on our shoes. So it's not only more comfortable, but it's incredibly sustainable. And we're allowing a lot of other people to use this material and do whatever else they want with it. And that offers something quite special to the world.
So that strikes me as a really remarkable opportunity, or it's sort of a paradigm that you can create an open source set of base materials, which are the core of manufacturing, which themselves embody drawdowns, aggregate out demand such that the price for those products goes down, more people adopt them. Then you can do your competitive sort of knickknacks on top of it so that everybody has their own value add from a consumer point of view, but you create the sort of virtuous sharing economy of products that draw down.
That's very, very well said. And yeah. I think the thing that's important to understand is that base level fiber, the base level polymer, the building blocks that are used for these materials are incredibly capital intensive to produce. And so a company like Allbirds, it's very difficult for us to spend the many millions of dollars to invest in capital equipment, pipes, reactors, pumps, and all of that stuff that's required to make this material, very difficult for one company to fund. So you have to go upstream and work with these giant multinational chemical companies to do that. And when you do that, it's very helpful to share that. And that's the way that collaboration and sustainability, particularly if you do it in the way where, as you mentioned, it's the building blocks. It's not the proprietary stuff that happens after. And you share that fundamental building block, and all of a sudden you get a really nice solution that everyone can use.
So let's close the loop, so to speak, and talk about eucalyptus. Tell us what the eucalyptus fiber does and what it contributes.
Yeah, so we call it our tree product line. And the tree product line is made from eucalyptus fibers. We source it sustainably from South Africa, and it's gone through a very green chemistry process subsequent to that harvesting. And it makes a proprietary yarn for us that we developed. And this yarn is cooling to the touch. It's got this inherent property of temperature regulation and moisture control as well. And it's a lot more breathable in the way that we manufacture that product than our merino wool line. So if you think about the offering we have, the merino wool is fairly all year round. But we also offer a very kind of, when it's really hot and humid summer day, we've created this mesh design with the tree product that allows it to breathe and air blow right through onto your foot. And that's not just an innovation around the fiber. That's also in the manufacturing process. And so this is where it gets a little deeper and complex, but we've knit this eucalyptus fiber into the shape of a shoe. So it eliminates waste and it also is form fitting. And we actually are allowed to then apply software so that we can design different attributes of the shoe. And we knit different points of durability to make sure we meet different constraints that when you're running around and you're on the streets of London every day, that you put on a shoe. So we knit that in through software, and that allows to take advantage of this great cooling and the beautiful properties of the eucalyptus while also providing all that durability through this knitting technique. And so that's the tree product line. We have a number of styles from ballet flats to sneakers to high tops. And those have been a really great offering to add on to merino wool and kind of for us the trifecta of those tactile and basic elements of sheep, trees, and sugar make up the building blocks for what we think are a pretty fantastic shoe that you can get at allbirds.co.uk.
Shameless plug, but I'm happy to, based on the sustainable credential of this remarkable company. So I'm going to pivot now into a conversation about sort of entrepreneurial daring do. But before I do, I'm going to ask one question which has been in the news recently, and that is the Amazon question. Mm-hmm. I might just express outrage on your behalf because you might feel constrained that you don't want to. But if I have the story right, Amazon has ripped off your design and is selling a shoe for half the price that has no sustainable credentials. Is that a fair summary?
Yes.
And this is the largest retailer in the world.
Correct.
So let me just restate that. You're a shoe company that is trying to be not just carbon neutral, but ultimately carbon negative. You are 4 or 5 years old. You're valued at $1.4 billion or more, but are still this pioneering attempt to try and marry together commerce and positive social impact. And the world's largest retailer has shamelessly, and I've looked at the images, copied your shoe, sold it at half the price to undercut what you've spent years developing yourselves, and done so in a way that doesn't reflect the externalities and the harm that the fashion, apparel, footwear industry otherwise inflicts on the world.
Yeah, I think it's part of the battle here, and we're trying to do something hard, and there's obviously a lot of competing forces working to do things the way they've always been done, because those have been profitable in the past. And yeah, Amazon introduces a really interesting dynamic into this market. They have more data than anyone in the world in retail. They understand, in the US, it's been cited that over 50% of product searches on the internet go through Amazon's search bar. And so they get what everyone wants. They know what everyone wants because everyone's searching into the bar. So if they understand what people want, that can direct their internal efforts to make something if they see a business opportunity. And you know, knowing what I know about a footwear production, there's absolutely no way you can profitably make and sell a shoe for $45 that applies the same rigorous sensitivities on the environment and animal welfare frankly, just quality craftsmanship that we use in our production to do so at that price. And so given that impossibility, I think I don't have much concern that this is going to impact our business, to be honest. I have confidence that we have priced this at a way that allows us to make a bit of money, but not so much that people can undercut us and still deliver the quality to consumers. So in the long run, this is a bump in the road that really doesn't give our company too much pause, but certainly grab some headlines, given that, as you said, they're a pretty dominant retailer. So yeah. So see how it goes.
I mean, I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about the planet, in the sense that you know, I think what this embodies is we live in a moment where entities that have enormous amounts of power have a corresponding level of responsibility imposed upon them. And if what entities which have, you know, the biggest retail footprint in the world do is look at sustainable products, copy them and undercut them in ways that don't take the embedded environmental impact in them, that's just grossly irresponsible.
Well, I think that's right. Yeah. And ironically, this product came out that you're referencing came out the same week they made their green pledge, and their green pledge was, you know, a step in the right direction. Of course, anything that companies do to green their workforce or green their impact is great, but given the scale and the scope of what they do, the irony around making that pledge that even to a lot of Amazon employees as they came out on the climate strike last week were unhappy with and didn't think was a sufficient impact on the world, and then come out with a product that, as you said, didn't adhere to the same fundamental principles of carbon mitigation is, it's ironic. And so I think that is, as you say, the responsibility. And if you're the most valuable company in the world, over $1 trillion of market valuation, I think taking that responsibility and doing something positive with it is the base level expectation that people should have of a company like that.
So let's do a little exercise in virality. Let's see how many people listen to this podcast and then forward it on to other people and urge them not to buy those shoes. I'm going to close by asking you three questions, advice to entrepreneurs who would like to follow your footsteps. Because one of my hypotheses is that if we are to stave off climate cataclysm, we need hundreds and thousands of Allbirds in the world, and people who, through entrepreneurship, through the application of capital, and through the production of things that people want, able to kind of positively impact the environment. So tell us the dumbest, most ill-considered thing that you've done on your journey so far, things that you would warn people not to do in a month of Sundays.
So I guess one of the biggest things we've faced, we're trying to do something a little different. And we're trying to do things a little different in a supply chain making shoes that's existed for, you know, 50 years now, this industrial process that's been used. And when we show up at these factories, they fight sometimes tooth and nail about the decisions we're asking for. So I'll give one example of something we really messed up on, and I think it's illuminating into what can be done. So when we made our first product, the Wool Runner, and we were going at a pretty fast pace, we asked for recycled polyester to use in the laces instead of virgin polyester. And they said it can't be done, and we accepted that. And they showed us a book of materials that we could use, and we're like, okay, that one's pretty, let's use that one. And what we realized very shortly thereafter was, until you push people to understand the way that you want your full embodiment of your principles and values to exist on a product, they don't really offer you what you're asking for. And so we continued to push for a few months, and probably about, I don't know, maybe a year into making the Wool Runners, we had our factory, they actually turned around and asked us, hey, by the way, you remember that lace that you wanted? Well, we found a way to do it. Here it is, it's three times the price, so, you know, we told you so. And we immediately turned around and said, yeah, we'll take it. And so we incurred three times the price for that, and we paid a lot extra for our laces. But it was then finally a product that we were comprehensively proud of. And subsequent, we were able to put the sweet foam in it, so then it was really complete. But I guess the lesson I learned is just don't question your values, and don't stray from your values when you're trying to do something that you think is important. And I think if I could give any one tip on entrepreneurship, it's don't do anything you're not authentically passionate about, because man, it gets hard. And when you're waking up every day and wondering why the hell you continue to work this hard and put all your, you know, put your family through it, put your relationships through everything you're asking of your network and relationships, it better be for a good reason. And so I think that's been one of the most powerful things for my personal motivation and attitude in running this business. And I think that trickles down from my co-founder, Tim, and myself into our entire employee population. But that said, it's so easy to break. And the laces on our shoes is a very small example, but that's a crack that can expand quite quickly if you let it. And so I think just don't do something passionate, and then don't stray from it even one degree.
Tell us a moment of desperation where you almost didn't make it, where this company now that's a remarkable success. There must have been some point where, had you not done X, you might have gone under, or you might have been on a very different path. Something yeah. sort of that you had to kind of grind your way through that was really tough.
Yeah, so we, I would say probably the most stressful time for me, which I think is a good proxy for your question, is we took $2 million when we started the company, because we had decided that we were either going to succeed wildly or fail miserably, not do something in between that. So we wanted to raise a bunch of money and give this its full a full try here, basically, and make sure that we put a nice brand out to the eyes of the consumer, spent everything we needed to spend on R&D, and have sufficient inventory to meet the demand if it existed when we launched the product. And then literally 1 week after we took that money, we found out that we did not have a factory anymore. And we had promised everyone that we had 7 months until we were going to produce and sell our first pair of shoes, and we lost a factory. And making shoes is very hard. It's an engineering problem with molded parts and soft textile components all coupled together through 36 process steps. That if you get one millimeter off in your tolerance, the shoe is scrap and it doesn't fit. So, okay. We got to do all that, scale up every one of these 36 process steps, and do so in a brand new factory in a process that typically takes 18 months, and we got to do it in 6 because we needed a month to ship it on the ocean. So we went with our master last maker from Italy, and I flew out to a couple different places, and we dug deep into our network. I talked to a guy I used to play soccer with when I was in high school and college. We talked to a woman who'd been advising us from the footwear industry for a bit. And we found factories in the US, in Romania, and in Korea. And I started interacting with all three of these. We sent them little sample packs and finally got to the streets of Korea with our Italian last maker, and had a very emotional exchange at one point that I recall, given the stress that I was feeling. And fortunately, we landed on a wonderful solution and found our now head of manufacturing, but then head of this factory in Korea. And we were able to make an incredibly beautiful shoe. And we were fortunate enough to be proud of the product and proud of the fact that we put it on the ocean and took 30 days to ship it slow, so that we didn't have to have the environmental or cost impact of air shipping for that first 10,000 pair order back in February of 2016.
For anybody who's been an entrepreneur, that's a wildly familiar story. Final question. What's your aspiration for the brand? Where are you taking it? What does the next 5 years look like for Allbirds?
So, you know, one of the things I'm a little bashful about, but at the same time boastful, if I could have that kind of strange juxtaposition there. But because we've aligned the values of the company with the financial outcome, and what I mean by that is, if somebody buys a pair of shoes from us, we think it's a net positive for the planet, and it's also good for our business. Because of that, I hope that we're absolutely enormous. And I think the bigger we are, the better our business is going to be. And the bigger we are, the better the planet's going to be. And so as shameless as I can say, I hope we're absolutely enormous in 5 years. I don't know what that looks like or what that means, but we're currently in 18 countries with a network of 7 warehouses that serves 1.75 billion people with free shipping and free returns with about 4 days maximum to shoes to your house. And we do that in the most environmentally sensitive way we can. And we would like to build stores in all these locations. We'd like to have incredible service through e-commerce in every one of these locations. And we'd like everyone to know about us. So doing things like this with you, Paul, is incredibly important for us.
Well, I wish you the greatest amount of luck. I suspect you are beyond the point of needing luck. It's execution and support and capital to enable you to expand. But I'm enormously grateful for you coming on the show. And I look forward to having you back in a year or two to discuss your hugeness.
Well, I'll take luck as well. And thanks again. And I'd love to come back. Appreciate it, Paul.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.